don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, Crypto Economy crew? Welcome back to the show. I hope everybody had a good weekend. So much blood in the streets happening right now. The price is nasty across the board. In fact, I think like the only thing really that is up right now is Ripple, of all things, the shittiest of shit coins, seems to hold on tight. So crazy moves in the market right now. I hope everybody is batten down the hatches. It's going to be enormously volatile here probably for a good little while going forward. And hopefully we will finish out the end of the year up from this position, but there's no telling. I think 4,800 is a pretty solid support zone right now, but I think it's all the way down to 4,000 really before there's another really, really hard support. So hopefully we don't go that low, but you know, maybe it's needed to shake out all the dumb money that is out there at the moment. So I don't know. Gonna be rough. Hope everybody has hedged their bets, or at least sitting in a position that does not destroy them with a move like this. With that though, we are going to be jumping into part three. I tweeted out earlier today that I have been crazy busy today, and I have got to get out of here. I literally just finally got home and sat down to record, and I got to get out of here in like an hour and a half. There's no way I'm going to finish section three in an hour and a half. Basically, a 30-minute episode usually takes me like 2 hours, and this is going to be a lot longer than that. So I'm just going to try to get through as much as I can get through today, and we will start back with section three tomorrow. And in addition, I am an idiot. I thought we had another week before Thanksgiving. I was just not watching my schedule, and I'm just looking at my week out plan. So I did not realize I am not going to be here Thursday or Friday of this week, and probably Wednesday is going to be completely taken up with work. So I might not even have episodes. I'm going to be so busy, I don't think I'm going to be able to get these ahead of schedule. I'm going to try to at least have one, maybe, if I can struggle and get two out, to extend this into maybe rather than Thanksgiving. I'll probably just skip Thanksgiving. Nobody will listen anyway on Thanksgiving. Most people do have something to do on Thanksgiving. But I might try to have maybe a Friday episode ready. We will see. I'm sorry for not properly looking at what the heck was coming up, but I'm going to try to get as much out as I can this week as possible, but this iterative capital thesis project will definitely extend into the following week here. All right, so without further ado, let's jump into section three of the iterative capital cryptocurrency phenomenon thesis titled Understanding How the Key Participants Organize. How hackers approach the building of their own private economy. Quote, every good work of software starts by scratching a developer's personal itch. Eric S. Raymond, speaking at the Linux Congress in Würzburg, Germany, 1997. In this section, we explore how the World Wide Web brought hackers together on message boards and email chains where they began to organize. We look at their ambition to build private networks and how they staked out requirements to build such a network using the lessons learned in earlier decades. Hackers begin developing free software. Out of the hacker culture grew an informal system of collaborative software making that existed outside of any individual company. Known as the free or open source software movement, and abbreviated FOSS, This social movement sought to popularize certain ethical priorities in the software industry. Namely, it lobbied for liberal licensing and against collecting or monetizing data about users or the way they are using a given piece of software. In a software context, the term free does not refer to the retail price, but to software free to distribute and modify. This sort of freedom to make derivative works is philosophically extended to mean free of surveillance and monetization of user data through violations of privacy. What exactly is the link between software licensing and surveillance? The Free Software Foundation says of commercial software, quote, "If we make a copy and give it to a friend, if we try to figure out how the program works, if we put a copy on more than one of our own computers in our own home, we could be caught and fined or put in jail." That's what's in the fine print of the license agreement you accept when using proprietary software. The corporations behind proprietary software will often spy on your activities and restrict you from sharing with others. And because our computers control much of our personal information and daily activities, proprietary software represents an unacceptable danger to a free society. End quote. Although the Free Software Foundation drew on philosophies from 1970s hacker culture and academia, its founder, MIT computer scientist Richard Stallman, effectively launched the free software movement in 1983 by launching GNU, or GNU, a free and open source set of software tools. A complete OS, or operating system, did not arrive until Linus Torvalds kernel was released in 1991, allowing GNU Linux to become a real alternative to Unix. Stallman founded the Free Software Foundation in 1985. This prescient cause foresaw the personal data hazards that might arise from platforms like Facebook, whose sloppy data-vendor relationships resulted in the violation of privacy of at least 87 million people in 2016. A bug allowed attackers to gain control of over 50 million Facebook accounts in 2018. The GNU Manifesto explicitly calls out the corporate work arrangement as a waste of time. It reads in part, emphasis added, quote, "We have already greatly reduced the amount of work that the whole society must do for its actual productivity, but only a little of this has translated itself into leisure for workers because much non-productive activity is required to accompany productive activity. The main causes of this are bureaucracy and isometric struggles against competition. The GNU Manifesto contends that free software has the potential to reduce these productivity drains in software production. It announces that movement towards free software is a technical imperative in order for technical gains in productivity to translate into less work for us." End quote. We have defined free software to mean, quote, "free of monetization techniques which contravene user privacy." In most cases, free software is free of all the trappings of commercialization, including restrictive copyrights, expensive licenses, and restrictions on alterations and redistribution. Bitcoin and Linux are examples of free software in both senses, both that it is free of surveillance and also free to distribute and copy. A system of values has evolved amongst free software developers who distinguish themselves from proprietary software companies, which do not share their internal innovations publicly for others to build on, and who track users and sell their personal data. Stallman's primary critique of commercial software was the preoccupation with unproductive competition and monetization. Quote, "The paradigm of competition is a race. By rewarding the winner, we encourage everyone to run faster. But if the runners forget why the reward is offered and become intent on winning no matter how, they may find other strategies, such as attacking other runners. If the runners get into a fist fight, they will all finish late. Proprietary and secret software is the moral equivalent of runners in a fist fight. There's nothing wrong with wanting pay for work or seeking to maximize one's income, as long as one does not use means that are destructive. But the means customary in the field of software today are based on destruction. Extracting money from users of a program by restricting their use of it is destructive because the restrictions reduce the amount and the ways that the program can be used. This reduces the amount of wealth that humanity derives from that program. When there is a deliberate choice to restrict, the harmful consequences are deliberate destruction. End quote. The non-productive work cited by Stallman harkens back to Veblen's conception of spurious technologies developed in the service of some internal ceremonial purpose to reinforce the existing company hierarchy. Quote, spurious technological developments are those which are encapsulated by a ceremonial power system whose main concern is to control the use, direction, and consequences of that development, while simultaneously serving as the institutional vehicle for defining the limits and boundaries upon that technology through special domination efforts of the legal system, the property system, and the information system. These limits and boundaries are generally set to best serve the institution seeking such control. This is the way the ruling and dominant institutions of society maintain and try to extend their hegemony over the lives of people. End quote. Hacker principles are codified in Cathedral versus Bazaar. In 1997, as the web was gaining momentum, hacker Eric Raymond presented a metaphor for the way hackers develop software together. He compared the hacker approach, which relied on voluntary contributions, to a marketplace of participants who could interact as they wished, a bazaar. Commercial software, he said, was like the building of a cathedral, with its emphasis on central planning and grand, abstract visions. The cathedral, he said, was overwrought, slow, and impersonally designed. Hacker software, he claimed, was adaptable and served a larger audience, like an open bazaar. With this metaphor in mind, Raymond codified 19 influential, quote, lessons on good practice in free, open-source software development. Some of the lessons appear below. 1. Every good work of software starts by scratching a developer's personal itch. 2. When you lose interest in a program, your last duty to it is to hand it off to a competent successor. 3. Treating your users as co-developers is your least hassle route to rapid code improvement and effective debugging. 4. Given a large enough beta tester and co-developer base, almost every problem will be characterized quickly and the fix obvious to someone. 5. Often the most striking and innovative solutions come from realizing that your concept of the problem was wrong. 6. Perfection in design is achieved not when there is nothing more to add, but rather when there is nothing more to take away. Attributed to Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. 7. Any tool should be useful in an expected way, but a truly great tool lends itself to uses you never expected. And 8. Provided the development coordinator has a communications medium at least as good as the internet and knows how to lead without coercion, many heads are inevitably better than one. These ideas would come to crystallize the hacker approach to building software. Hacker subcultures collide in cyberspace. As the web proliferated, hacker subcultures collided on message boards and forums. All of them found they had a core set of common attitudes and behaviors, including sharing software and information, freedom of inquiry, the right to fork the software, distaste for authority, playfulness and cleverness. But they had different ideas about how the internet would develop in the future. Utopian ideas about the power of computer networks to create post-capitalist societies had emerged as early as 1968. The utopians thought networked computers might allow society to live in a kind of Garden of Eden, mediated by autonomous computerized agents free of labor and coexisting with nature. There were also dystopian visions. A young fiction writer, William Gibson, first coined the term cyberspace with his 1981 short story, Burning Chrome. In his conception, cyberspace was a place where massive corporations would operate with impunity. In his story, hackers could enter into hyperspace in a literal way, transversing systems that were so powerful they could crush human minds. In cyberspace, Gibson imagined, government was powerless to protect anyone. There were no laws, and politicians were irrelevant. It was nothing but the raw and brutal power of the modern conglomerate. Gibson, Bruce Sterling, Rudy Rucker, and other writers went on to form the core of this radically dystopian literary movement. The Utopians start getting rich. Another group of hackers hailed from the original 1960s counterculture. Many of them had a sanguine outlook on the web as a new, safe world where radical things could come true. Like with the acid counterculture, cyberspace could be a place where individuals were liberated from old, corrupt power hierarchies. This optimistic view pervaded the entrepreneurial circles of Silicon Valley in the 1980s and 1990s, creating an extremely positive view of technology as both a force for good and a path to riches. One British academic wrote at the time, quote, "This new faith has emerged from a bizarre fusion of the cultural bohemianism of San Francisco with the high-tech industries of Silicon Valley. It promiscuously combines the freewheeling spirit of the hippies and the entrepreneurial zeal of the yuppies. This amalgamation of opposites has been achieved through a profound faith in the emancipatory potential of the new information technologies. In the digital utopia, everyone will be both hip and rich." End quote. The ideas of the, quote, aging hippies culminated with the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace in 1996, written by a former Grateful Dead lyricist named John Perry Barlow, who had been part of the acid counterculture. By the mid-1990s, Silicon Valley startup culture and the upstart Wired magazine were coalescing around Barlow's utopian vision of the World Wide Web. He began holding gatherings he called Cyberthons as an attempt to bring the movement together. They unintentionally became a breeding ground for entrepreneurship, says Barlow. Quote, "As it was conceived, Cyberthon was supposed to be the 90s equivalent of the acid test, and we had thought to involve some of the same personnel, but it immediately acquired a financial commercial quality, which was initially a little unsettling to an old hippie like me. But as soon as I saw it actually working, I thought, oh well, if you're going to have an acid test for the 90s, money better be involved." End quote. Emergence of the cypherpunk movement. All right, I think that's a good place to start. I am out of time today. I got to rush out of here really quick. This will be partway through, maybe about a third of the way through section three. Like I said, this one was a really long section. So we will jump right back into this at the emergence of the cypherpunk movement. And don't forget to follow Iterative Capital. You can find them at Iterative Cap on Twitter, and check out their newsletter and their page. They are constantly publishing stuff. I'm trying to keep up with it, but I've been really busy lately, so I haven't really been able to dig into much other stuff other than this thesis right now, which I hope you guys are enjoying as much as I am. But don't forget to check them out, and I will link to Chris Dannon and the other, or I will tag them, Chris Dannon and the other guys, on the Twitter post so that you can find them as well. Or you could, of course, go to the About page and check out their whole team, find their LinkedIn and their Twitter pages to follow them and keep up with the awesome work that they are doing over there. Don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter and Mastodon, and you can check out Reddit r/CryptoEconomy, and you can find me on Medium at The Crypto Economy as well. I got that tag pretty much everywhere I'm going now, and the best place to find all of that stuff is at CryptoEconomy.life. Guys, the collection of stuff over there is getting huge. I just released, I don't even think I announced this on the show, I just released the Bitcoin Survivors book list. This is a collection of books that I have either read, or there's like one or two books in there now. I'm just now finishing up The Selfish Gene, which is amazing. I've been killing that one. I just destroyed that through the weekend and late last week. So I got through that one really, really fast. But there are so many good books in that list. I consider that the, if you're trying to look for the bulk of the perspective to understand Bitcoin maximalism and have perspective and insight around this whole space, I think there is a lot of great reading up there. The whole list is stuff that I considered incredibly impactful to me when I read them, and or the couple that I am trying to get to as soon as possible are ones that so many people have told me are critical reads that I had to add it to the list. So, and there will probably be things added to that. So don't forget to check that one out. And pretty much every one of them, a number of them are free books. You can get them off Mises, or I've got Shelling Out up there, which obviously you can get for free. Just on my website, I've got the audio book that I did, the long read, and also the link straight to read it on Nakamoto Institute or Unenumerated. So there are some free options up there, but all the other ones on Amazon, there are typically audiobooks available, I think, for the majority of them. But each one of them is also an affiliate link. So if you do get those books, be sure to do it through my website, because it'll send a couple of bucks my way and help keep this show running. It takes a lot of time and capital to keep this thing alive. So any help that you guys could give. I've also got an Amazon affiliate link on the website. It's just a little ad at the top of the page. Using those links is a huge, huge help. Thank you so much to everyone who has donated to the show or used my affiliate link in the past. Like I said, it keeps this thing running and keeps coffee in my mug, so I'm here with the energy to read and tackle these projects on the show. All right, guys, I will close this here. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Leave me a review if you're liking the show, and stick with us. We are coming back here tomorrow with continuing part 3, and I'm going to get out as much as I can towards the end of the week. See you all tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.